radio show listeners, welcome to this week's program. Will Birch is our guest. I should mention he's our returning guest. He was on the show once before, as was Nick Lowe a few times. Nick Lowe has been on the show, I think, four times. And all of these are preserved over at WFMU.org/Michael. You can listen to them anytime. If you're just, you know, joining us and don't know about the archives, they're all free. And no commercials, nothing like that. Reckless Eric, some other folks who had some dealings with the Stiff Records I've talked to also up there. Take a look, WFMU.org/Michael. So yes, it's Will Birch returning today to talk about his brand new book, his biography of Nick Lowe. I loved it. Of course, I love Nick Lowe. They just did an in-store at the Strand where there was a little Q&A about the book and about Nick's career, including some interesting index cards that audience members wrote questions on. And it's just great to see them. And then Nick did a couple of live songs just with acoustic guitar, including a version of Cruel to Be Kind that was just a little bit slow and slightly mournful. I found it unusually moving. It was just being in Nick's presence. I don't know. Maybe it's just my melancholy phase. I don't know. But I'm trying to tell you, I love Nick Lowe. So I was just pleased to be able to talk about him with Will Birch and try to sort of crack the code about what makes this man who he is, such a special performer. Hope you enjoy this. Talk to you soon. All right, there is some Nick Lowe music, and Will Birch is with me. We're up in Studio B, and he's the author, as we've been talking about, the new book, Cruel to Be Kind, The Life and Music of Nick Lowe. I should say, welcome back to WFMU. Will, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, Michael. Good to be here on a nice sunny day in New Jersey.
It's lovely, yeah. You were telling me your first PATH train experience, first sojourn into New Jersey. You were on the show January 2015. We talked mostly about your book, No Sleep Till Canvey Island, which I consider one of my all-time favorite rock books, and I've read, you know, way too many of them. And I should point out that I looked last night, and it's selling, the cheapest copy was $99 on Amazon.com for the paperback edition. I love that book. So I just want to remind people and thank you for being on the show previously. So this new Nick Lowe book, of course, I love Nick Lowe. He's a favorite of mine, favorite of the show. I read the book. I really enjoyed it. How's reaction so far?
How's Nick's reaction been?
Both the public and Nick's.
Well, the public reaction, as much as I see of it, mainly on social media these days, has been extremely positive. And two or three people are saying, I'm reading it very slowly to savor it, which is nice for me to hear.
Yeah, that's a good sign.
And that's complimentary. The reviews in the UK have been very, very good. You know, 5 stars in Mojo magazine, and all the big music magazines have given it very good reviews. So, yeah, it's only been out a couple of weeks. So,
and Nick is happy?
Nick is as happy as Nick is ever going to be about a book written about his life.
Fair enough. How long did it take to put something like this together? I mean, it's a big, huge book. There's clearly a ton of research. When did you start working on it?
I started working on it in 2011. These kinds of biographies, I mean, I've only written 3 books, but each one has taken at least 7 or 8 years. Not all day, every day. Obviously, I do other stuff, but It's a very long process, because if you make a list of 60 people you'd like to interview, you may know some of them personally, but some of them you don't know. You've got to track them down. You've got to get them to agree. Then you've got to hook up with them, either in person or on the phone, Skype or whatever. Then you listen to them for an hour, 2 hours. That takes 2 days to transcribe. If you're doing 50 or 60 interviews, you can only really do 1 or 2 at a time. So it probably, from start to finish, one person will take about a month, actually. And then they might cancel or postpone.
Were there people who said no?
Well, yes, there were. There was one particular gentleman who I was the first interview I did. Well, the very first interview I did was with Nick's sister, Penny. But the second interview I did was with a well-known, or certainly well-known in Nick Lowe's world, musician. And I went to his house, and he very graciously met me at the station, and I was there for several hours, a long, long interview. I transcribed it, and then about 2 years ago, when I was putting it all together, I thought, well, I better just check that he's happy with what I'm saying about what he said. I sent him a transcript of his the bits of the interview I was using, and he said, fine, no problem. No, oh, one little mistake, can you change that to that? No problem, did it. Then right before the book went to print, the publisher said to me, our legal department have asked us for you to get confirmation from all of the major interviews you've done that they're happy. And I had to send all the stuff out, and 99 out of 100 said no problem. But this particular person suddenly goes, I don't want any of my quotes in the book. I've come to realise that the position I find myself in life. And he went off on one, and I won't tell you his name, but you probably will guess. However, the stories are still in the book. So
just not accredited to him.
He doesn't say, and then Fred said. Huh. Because most of the stuff I kind of knew about the events.
How interesting.
Yeah, he. And then there was another person quite prominent in Nick's musical career who also said, I don't want anything attributed to me. He's obviously mentioned in the book. So I did have two cases of that, yeah. But everyone else has been fine.
The book is not authorized, but it was done clearly with Nick's cooperation. And I sort of took that a little bit of a sign of Nick's humility. You know, it just it would be too much for him to authorize such a thing.
Yes. I mean, I was asked by my publisher when we were seeking a publishing contract for the book, well, one in America and one in the UK. They both said, is it an authorized biography? And I said, well, I don't really want it to be called an authorized biography, because when you see that, you tend to suspect it's been sort of sanitized and all the meat's been taken out of it, which isn't the case. So it's not formally authorized, but after having done dozens of interviews with Nick over the last, well, 30 years, but certainly a hell of a lot of interviews in the last 7 or 8 years, it's got his blessing, yeah. His Nick's thing is, you know, you've probably read the interviews he does where people say, how do you feel about this biography coming? I don't really approve of it, he'll say, you know, but he's been very supportive, and he's been great.
It's tough because your colleagues, your friends, you're a fan. There are some tough subjects in the book. The one that comes to mind right now is his LSD use, which was kind of a shocker to me, and I could see why, if you're Nick Lowe, you don't really want the public to know that, you know, there was a time in your life where you took LSD a real lot. Is it hard? Was it hard for you to go to those dark places? And in the end, did he ever waver? Maybe that shouldn't be in the book.
Well, the LSD story was in No Sleep Till Canvey Island, my previous book, which obviously I had to cannibalize a little bit for some of the material for the Nick Lowe biography, because it's the same story. But everything about Nick, I ran past him. In fact, I said to him one day, are you sure you're happy with this story going in? You know, you've got a 12-year-old son. And
yeah.
And he said, no, it's what happened. It's got to go in. It's got to be the truth. Mm. But we did remove some material, was, you know, edited out. But, yeah, well, it was a dark time in his life, you know. But he says of it, you know, he said, I think people who go through that are a certain, they come out a certain way and it stays with them forever. He said, I recognize it in other people who had the same experience back in the 1960s, early 70s. And, you know, if you've had enough bad trips, I suppose it stays with you.
Yeah. I get the feeling, observing him, hanging out with him just a little bit, that he has a set of rules that he lives by, you know, that he's a little tightly packaged, and that I'm not sure the guy we see is, I'm not sure how much of that is him and how much of that is a public guy that he puts on when he steps out the front door.
Do you mean by that he might be a bit uptight about things or a little bit?
Well, it's funny because he balances what I'm talking about with a very sense of being very cool. You know, he walks into the room, he seems relaxed, he seems like the man to you know, to go gather around. But at the same time, I guess it's the other side of being cool, is that there's a little bit of reserve there.
Yes, I mean, I think, I don't know intimately what his sort of daily routines are, but I, having listened to him tell me about how he writes songs, for example, or how he gets ready to go on tour, how he has to become the guy who goes on tour. He's at home 2 or 3 weeks before he goes on tour. He has to do the standard domestic stuff. He's got a young teenage son and a family at home. He has to go do shopping. He has to walk the dog. He has to go to the car wash. In fact, he was on his way to the car wash when I spoke to him on the phone last week. Excuse me if I cut off, but I'm waiting to be picked up to go to the car wash. So he has to do all that stuff. And in order to do that, he says he has to become Dennis. But Dennis can't do what Nick does. So he has this sort of alter ego.
And what is the transformation process? Is it?
He has to get into character before he goes on tour. Huh. And he said it takes him, you know, a week or 10 days to start thinking in tour mode, apart from getting the physical, practical stuff together, like packing his suitcase and making sure he's got his work permit and his guitar is in tune. Apart from the obvious stuff, he also has to get into a frame of mind and, as he said, be the guy who can go on stage and say, "Hello, Cleveland."
That's fascinating and an illuminating answer. One of the interesting things about the book is that it takes us through a really interesting time in music, from his early school band days to Kippington Lodge, which is kind of the school band. It's kind of like a mod 60s band, you know, with ridiculous clothing, and they sort of morph into a ridiculous hippie band that morphs at the very end of their career. Brinsley Schwartz kind of morphs into, you can just hear a little bit of new wave music in the very end. And then he becomes, you know, associated with punk and then new wave and then the 1980s and then his rebirth. It's quite the whole story of the music business in one career.
It's a fantastic musical journey. The interesting thing is Nicky's of an age, as am I, where we as young children remember music before rock and roll. By which I mean before Elvis and Little Richard came along. So our parents were playing Doris Day, Frank Sinatra, Harry Belafonte or whatever. And what to now would be middle of the road music, film music as well. And that, I think, for anybody who lived through that, I think that gives you a certain grounding in the value of the song. And then, of course, when rock and roll came along, it was bang, 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 and all the fireworks went off, which is where Nick's really started to get interested and got his banjo and started playing in school groups. But he's been through almost every trend, really. I mean, Kippington Lodge wanted to be, I guess they wanted to be The Move, you know, for example, you know, sort of pop mod group. They were signed to Parlophone, EMI. The Beatles were still going when Kippington Lodge were making the records. That's how long ago that was. And then most of them became Brinsley Schwartz. And, well, of course, what happened? The famous trip to New York where they played the Fillmore Auditorium in, well, it'll be 50 years ago next April, actually. That went disastrously wrong for 1,000. I mean, the only thing that didn't go wrong is the plane didn't crash. I mean, apart from that, it all went wrong. And they came back to London with their tail between their legs, and they were a laughing stock. And the only way they could survive it was to completely turn it round. And they turned their back on that hype and commerciality and took music back to, I guess, what they thought were the roots, its roots. Really, of course, they were influenced by the band. I mean, that's the real thing. They wanted to be the band. And you see those pictures of the band. They look like they're in the American Civil War, don't they? And there's the old beard and the old check shirt and funny trilby hat, you know. And that's what Brinsley Schwartz, the band, wanted to be. But then after 5 years of that, things are starting to change. And Nick's always had his ear to the ground. He can kind of sense something's happening before it's happened, you know. And he says that he and Jake Riviera, who became his manager, when Brinsley Schwartz broke up, they both knew something was going to happen. They couldn't quite put their finger on it. Of course, that became punk rock, really, is what really
happened. It's such an exciting moment. There's a great moment in Nick's career where I think Brinsley Schwartz is about to go on a TV show, and Nick walks in with a haircut. He no longer looks like a hippie, and the rest of the band all feel like a bunch of jerks because they're all still wearing, you know, these bell-bottom jeans and stuff, and Nick has evolved already.
Yeah, Nick obviously remembered his mod days from 7 or 8 years earlier and went and got the same haircut he probably aspired to back in 66 or whenever. And yes, and he didn't tell the others, and they went on this quite well-known TV show in England called The Old Grey Whistle Test. I think you can see clips of it on YouTube. Yeah. And the other guys in the band have all got beards and long hair, and they've probably got the big flared trousers on, and he's got the tight jeans and the mod, very nice haircut. In fact, I think he must have come directly from the hairstylist to the studio, and it didn't rain on the way to preserve that look, yeah. The others were embarrassed by that, I think, you know.
Yeah, I think so. And it's a wonderful moment in rock history. I love Nick Lowe. He's one of those people who musicians especially love, I think. You know, people with good taste love Nick Lowe. There's just something about him. People, the amount of people who've covered his songs and the amount of press he gets is out of whack with the number of records he sells, you know. Everybody loves him. Were you able, in writing the book and doing the research, to put into words why he's so good or what makes him that way? You know, what is it about him that draws people to him?
Well, I think he's obviously, I say obviously, he's a very, very good songwriter. That's the main thing. We mustn't forget that. And when I totted up the well-known people who had covered his songs, I almost couldn't believe it. And you think about it, Johnny Cash, Tom Petty, Rod Stewart, Diana Ross, Curtis Stigers, Elvis Costello. The list is endless of quite famous singers, much more famous than Nick Lowe. So the songs stand up. Before you get to Nick the man, the songs stand up. But he's always had a way of presenting himself and presenting his material and being just, I don't know, about one step ahead, but he's always quite aware of things that are on the horizon, and he doesn't mind also changing tack halfway through. So in other words, if he finds himself going down what might be a bit of a blind alley, he will do completely the opposite just for the sheer hell of it. You know, when he writes a ballad like I Read a Lot, or House for Sale, or You Inspire Me is the best example. They're like songs from 1953. They're before rock and roll.
Yeah, like what you were talking about.
Yeah, and he can do that. And I think a lot of musicians who are, as I say, much more successful and well-known than Nick is, they're kind of slightly envious of this ability. It's a very rare commodity. I mean, I can't think of hardly anybody else who does it. There's a few examples. I mean, obviously, Bob Dylan and Neil Young and people like that are out on their own. But if you think about guys that came out of the 60s, 70s, things, there's very few people who think like Nick, very few. Yeah. Costello does a bit. But as Nick says, of Costello, too many words, too many chords. But of course, they love each other. It's a bit of fun and games, I think.
In the press materials for the book, Nick is described as Britain's best songwriter. It's all over, but there's no attribution. Who said that?
Well, I think the bio probably says something like, once described as, yes, or often described as, Britain's greatest songwriter. And it's definitely a quote I found, and was quite keen to put in.
I'm not disagreeing, I'm just curious.
If only to stimulate some discussion. Costello actually said, here's the thing, when, you know, Costello had that TV show Spectacle, when Nick was on that night, I think Levon Helm was on, and Richard Thompson maybe. Oh, great.
Alan Toussaint,
wow, what a lineup.
Yeah.
And as Nick goes off stage, Costello actually says, thank you, England's greatest songwriter. And I thought to myself, yeah, yes, Elvis, not Britain's, you're Britain's, he's England's.
I see.
I don't know who said Britain's greatest songwriter, but somebody did. I'll find it.
Brexit, we'll have to re-look at all of this stuff. Is he a hard worker? Is that a part of his thing?
I think that he, when he's on, when he's got a song between his teeth, you know, he's got a song on the go,
yeah,
he will apply himself. And when he's on tour, he's very, very conscientious about his presentation, keeping himself in shape, you know, just taking it easy, as against the old days where, of course, in the 80s, he was a complete riot on tour. He's now much more considered. But he will go through periods of inactivity. You know, I mean, Jake Riviera, his former manager, described Nick as the least hardworking man in show business. And he can be incredibly lazy. But if that's what produces a house for sale or I read a lot, then that's the process. You know, songwriting and inspiration is a very odd thing to really understand how it happens. And when it happens, you've got to capture it. You know, you walk down the street and you get a great idea for a song, a title, just a title. You've got to capture it and write it down. You can't let it go. You'll never remember it again. And he's like that. He will take a vacation, but he's kind of always thinking, there might be a song there, you know, in what I'm doing. Yeah. So, yeah. He could have done a lot more touring. I mean, I think that he's doing a lot of touring now compared to what he did in the 90s and the noughties.
Yeah.
You know, I think he went one year. I think 2000, I can't remember which year, like 2002 or something. I think barely did a live show, you know. Now, of course, he's on tour a fair bit.
Yeah, but definitely between like Pinker and Prouder and Previous and Impossible Bird, there's not a lot of live.
Not a lot of touring. He went out on the road with Elvis Costello once or twice, solo acoustic. Australia, I think they did, and America.
I guess it's good to have those mailbox checks showing up to pay the bills, you know.
Well, I think that although there's this story about he made $1 million from The Bodyguard, because the Curtis Steiger's version of What's So Funny About Peace, Love and Understanding was on the soundtrack album, which reportedly sold 45 million units, so Arista claim, bigger than Thriller. I mean, the biggest selling record ever. And Nick's got, what, 18 tracks on there? He's got a piece of that. And he did get a very nice royalty check, I believe. And the thing about that was, two things about that. One, it enabled him to work at his own pace, in his own way. And out of that came The Impossible Bird, which was the start of his artistic rebirth. Or that's, people think that and say that.
Yeah, yeah.
And he could work with the musicians he wanted. He could pay them a good fee for playing on his records. Same with the recording record producer, engineer. And he could work. So if an album took 2.5 years to do, so be it. And they're great records, you know, The Convincer, Dig My Mood. They're fabulous albums. He wouldn't have had that luxury had he been signed to a major label, because they'd be whacking the, you know, whip all day long. Come on, Nick, next album, which is what he went through in the 80s, and he hated it.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, had he not had that piece of good fortune, he would, I guess, be thought of as a journeyman musician, like an almost guy who has to work the road nonstop to bring the, you know, to pay the rent.
Yeah.
He had the luxury of not having to do that too much for a few years. I guess that money might be running out by now. I don't know. None of my business.
You mentioned the 1980s. Whenever that subject comes up, Nick sort of looks at his shoes and doesn't seem to want to visit those records or those tours or that time or the songs. Really not happy with those records at all.
I think probably now, with the benefit of, well, it's hindsight, of the benefit of experience, he's probably a little bit embarrassed by that period. I mean, each of those albums, the Cowboy Outfit and Rose of England, I thought was a terrific record. I really thought that was good.
But yeah.
The other two or three, I mean, I think that The Abominable Showman, I think, is his weakest piece of work. There's barely, I mean, I don't rate it at all. And he was under pressure to deliver an album a year and then go on tour. He had the same band, lovely guys, Martin, Paul Carrack, Bobby and James, fantastic band. But there was a lot of drinking going on, shall we say, and a lot of touring and a lot of complete madness. In fact, he said, it was Paul Carrack, I think, who pulled the plug on it. I think they came back off an American tour after about 7 years of doing this stuff, and Paul says, I cannot live this sort of life anymore. And he went off and founded, well, he has a very successful solo career now, particularly in the UK.
Yeah.
Paul was the guy who kind of pulled the plug, but I think Nick looks back on it as maybe wasted years. I don't know. Johnny Cash was still alive. You see, Johnny Cash had already done Without Love in 79, I think he cut that. And then Nick was working on The Beast in Me, which was took him about 9-10 years to finish. I saw a letter, actually, round at Nick's house, written by Johnny Cash to Nick, In which Cash says, "I'm speaking to this letter was in the 80s." He said, "I'm speaking to the people at Columbia to see if you can maybe produce my next album." Hmm. And it didn't happen, but Cash was definitely thinking along those lines.
That's too
bad. Which is great.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned, I guess, what you might call Nick's third act, that he sort of had to reinvent himself after the 80s, even into the 90s. And in some ways, it points to an ambitious man, right? Who else is going to... He could have rested on his royalties or on, mediocreness, but he chose not to just keep playing the old songs, to really start almost from scratch again. Does that point to ambition, or is it inspiration, or what is it?
I wouldn't say it's ambition, because I think if it was ambition, he would have taken it on the road and worked it much harder than he did. But I think it's a byproduct of creativity and inspiration. And he knew it was a path he had to go down. When he gets an idea for a song, and his story is, he says, and he said this a lot in interviews, he knows it's a good song when he sounds like something I haven't written. His story is that he doesn't really write the songs. He hears it on a radio station in the apartment next door coming through the wall.
Yeah.
And he can just pick up one bit of it. And when he sits down, it might take him months to finish the song. And when it's finished... And he said it's as if someone else has written it, and then he knows it's good enough to go on a record. Mm. I don't think he can't do anything else. I mean, it's what he's put on the earth to do.
Yeah.
It would be wrong of him not to follow his inspiration and his creativity. It'd be a waste. It's like anybody, if you can paint well or write well or I don't know, play soccer, whatever. If you don't follow that path, then it's a waste, isn't it? So I think he feels a responsibility. It sounds a bit heavy, that, really. It sounds a bit big, oh, yeah, he's only doing it for a laugh. But I think he does take it very seriously, yeah. Certainly the songwriting, yeah.
Is he happy? You think he's a happy guy?
I think he's very happy. And there's that corny expression, happy in his own skin. But that does kind of sum it up, although it's a cliche. Yeah, I think he feels pretty good about himself, He says he gets a bit of arthritis in his hands and it gives him trouble holding the chords down, but certainly doesn't come across when he's strumming away.
Yeah.
I would say he's very happy, yeah.
In the end, I mean, the purpose of a biography, to find out why this guy is the way he is. I mean, just is there a secret? What does it all boil down to? Why is Nick Lowe the way Nick Lowe is?
I think he's quite keen on himself. I mean, I think he knows kind of what works. And that, of course, comes over in the way he presents himself in public and on stage. And he tells a good yarn as well. He's a brilliant storyteller, raconteur. And he knows he's a pretty good act. I mean, there's a bit of conceit there. But you need that, otherwise you just end up like...
He's slightly tongue-in-cheek also,
He Yes. Doesn't wish to come over as taking himself too seriously or being too earnest.
Yeah.
But, of course, he is earnest and serious. He's a bit of a conundrum, really. I don't know if he's honest up to a point, but he will start laying on a bit of dishonesty. I'm shooting off the top of my head now. I don't really know what I'm saying, but he will, if something works for him, he'll say what he thinks is the thing to say at that point, And in that sense, he is honest. I mean, he doesn't beat about the bush. If he doesn't want to do something, he just says, nope, and he said no to me a few times. For example, would you come and do a signing at Freddie's bookshop up in Birmingham? I don't think I can do that, Funnily enough, I said... If I could fix something up in, let's say, in New York City, somewhere like Strand Books, he went, yep. Mm-hmm. And he was there like a shot. It was just great.
Mm. Do you have a favorite Nick Lowe song?
Yeah, favorites, well, four or five, really. All Men Are Liars. Lately, I've Let Things Slide, I think is a terrific song about probably waking up with a hangover, a single guy disgusted by the fact he's taken a shirt from the laundry that's the least dirty and he's left the front door open wide. That's a favourite. I like Bay City Rollers, We Love You, although that is a novelty song. I just love that.
Yes, perfect.
You know, Heart of the City, as I say, All Men Are Liars, Rose of England, fantastic. You Inspire Me. Yeah, they're the songs that come to mind immediately.
Well, let's hear Lately I've Let Things Slide. Will Birch has been our guest. The book is called Cruel to Be Kind, The Life and Music of Nick Lowe, and website is willbirch.com. Folks can get information. I think you can buy a copy of the book there. There's links and stuff there. And more information about your whole career, all of your writing and your music making and songwriting and stuff. Thanks for visiting with us. Fascinating. Loved the book.
Thank you, Michael. Been great talking with you. Thank you.
With a growing sense of dread and a hammer in my head, fully clothed upon the bed, I wake up to the world that lately I've been living in. There's a cut upon my brow, must have banged myself somehow, but I can't remember now. And the front door's open wide, lately I've let things slide. I go to the bin, I throw the laundry in, and pick out the cleanest shirt. Then I tell myself again, I don't really hurt. Smoking I once quit, now I got one lit. I just fell back into it, along with my pride. Lately I've let things slide. Evidence is clear on every side, piled high and wide, about how lately I let things slide. I'm just about holding on, but lately I've let things slide.